The Island Digest is a sampling of the stories in this week's Journal of the San Juans, Islands Sounder, and Islands Weekly, which are on newsstands now. The August 23rd edition is brought to you by Orcus Center. I'm Caleb Summers. Headlines from the week of August 23rd, 2023. Pet owners not complying with leash laws in Moran. Tokite's death ends dream to return her home. Research aims to uncover causes of eelgrass decline, plus choice excerpts from the sheriff's log. First, from the Islands Sounder, Pet Owners Not Complying with Leash Laws in Moran, by Colleen Smith Summers. Not leashing your dog in a state park can have serious consequences. The offense is punishable by a $99 fine that is processed through the local court system, and if your pet causes harm to another human or animal, you could be ordered to pay medical fees and undergo a dangerous dog hearing. "We have had some people report incidents this summer," said Moran State Park Ranger Allison Clark. "It is really important for folks to call 911 immediately when this happens. And we have trained law enforcement rangers who can help. We can't do anything if we don't know about it." Orcas resident Leslie Little and her 13-pound dog Maisie were sitting with a friend at Twin Lakes on August 8th when three off-leash dogs came running towards them, immediately going for Little's dog. "I couldn't see or hear anything but screaming, and the lead dog was trying to get her teeth into Maisie while I tried to hang on and protect her and slid downwards," Little said. "We were fortunate that the dog owners witnessed the attack and were able to pull the dogs off of me. We are okay. We were bruised and had a couple of punctures, but were mostly just shaken up. This could have been so much worse." According to Washington Administrative Code 352-32060, all pets or domestic animals must be kept under physical control on a leash no greater than 8 feet in length or otherwise physically restrained at all times while in a state park area. Clark notes this is true for cats and other pets. She's even seen ferrets on trail walks. "We have contacts daily with folks this summer on the campground or the trails who are not complying. It's important for public safety and everyone's enjoyment of the park," Clark explained. "You don't know if someone else is afraid of dogs. We also have folks in the park of all ages, and some are more nimble at getting around pets, so having them on a leash is important. It also protects the wildlife. Our piebald deer are one of our treasured species out here, and it's a danger to the pet to run off-leash. I was dispatched to a call for an owner who couldn't get back to their dog because its collar was hooked on a branch on a cliff." Sheriff Eric Peter said an incident in Moran State Park on August 2nd has led to a potentially dangerous dog hearing in district court. Under county and state law, a dog can be designated as potentially dangerous if, when unprovoked, it bites a human or domestic animal on public or private property. If given that label, the owner must register their pet as a dangerous dog, which costs $500. According to county code, the dog must also have $250,000 insurance and a microchip embedded under their skin to keep track of their location. Euthanasia is usually a last resort. The county council recently amended the ordinance because the appeals process wasn't clear, Peter said. The verbiage is now corrected, and the county leash law states that unless you are in a designated dog park, your dog has to be on a leash. Clark says Moran State Park has instituted a new program to reward responsible pet owners. "We are trying to do patrols every day, and this year we started the Bark Ranger Project, where we are encouraging people to leash their pets and follow these laws. If you are compliant, we thank you and provide badges for your dog's collar and special Bark Ranger leashes. We're trying to build a safe place for everyone to come and enjoy. Tokite's Death Ends Dream to Return Her Home by Kelly Balcombartuk. The last remaining southern resident killer whale taken from the Salish Sea during the captures of the late 1960s and early 1970s died suddenly Friday, August 18th, in the small pool she'd spent the last 53 years living in. Lolita, a.k.a. Tokite, a.k.a. Skali Chuktenot, outlived over 50 other southern resident killer whales taken decades ago from Pacific Northwest waters at the Miami Seaquarium in Florida. In a statement released Friday from the Friends of Toki, a nonprofit working closely with the Miami Seaquarium to return Tokite to the Pacific Northwest, over the last 2 days, Toki started exhibiting serious signs of discomfort, which her full Miami Seaquarium and Friends of Toki medical team began treating immediately and aggressively. Despite receiving the best possible medical care, she passed away Friday afternoon from what is believed to be a renal condition. Toki was an inspiration to all who had the fortune to hear her story, and especially to the Lummi Nation that considered her family. Those of us who have had the honor and privilege to spend time with her will forever remember her beautiful spirit, the statement continues. Tokite's death was a shock heard around the world, especially when you consider this whale was on the verge of returning home, retiring after 53 years in show business. Following the decades of living in a small pool in the Miami heat, Tokite was actively being prepared for transport, including training exercises to familiarize herself with the sling she'd be lifted in when that fateful day arrived. In recent years, a number of critical factors had aligned to make her return to the Salish Sea a reality, so much so that there was genuine reason for hope and optimism that she would in fact experience the cold waters of the inland Salish Sea for the first time in over 5 decades. In an interview just prior to Tokite's death, Charles Vinick spoke of the unprecedented changes that had led to the effort to bring Tokite home. First, the purchase of the Miami Seaquarium by the Dolphin Company and the reports from the USDA really galvanized the effort that led to where we are today, says Vinick. Vinick is executive director of the Whale Sanctuary Project and co-founder of Friends of Toki, a nonprofit corporation that was dedicated to supporting efforts to help improve the life and living conditions of Skali Chuktenot. I think most significantly, says Vinick about the recent groundswell of support for Skali Chuktenot that had been building, was the Lummi Nation, and particularly the Sacred Sea, Sacred Lands Conservancy and Raynell Morris, Ellie Kinley, and Julie Trimingham. As a nonprofit organization that really were throughout 2019 leading the charge, if you will, to bring Toki home. Around that same time, Lummi more broadly were beginning to plan for and then do the totem pole journey around the country, and specifically back to Miami, says Vinick. So there was an indigenous effort to bring Toki home that we in the Whale Sanctuary Project were asked to assist with, and were pleased to do so. At that time, Vinick and others began to develop the beginning of an operational plan for this to be led and carried out by the indigenous tribes, and particularly by Lummi. So we worked with them in that regard. We certainly helped to look at sites, we modified the plans that we already had in place for moving cetaceans for the Whale Sanctuary Project, and we tailored this directly to the work for Toki. And that led to our engagement with them frequently and regularly throughout that period. According to Vinick, it was only when they began to hear 2 things simultaneously near the end of 2021 that really galvanized the effort that has led to where they are today. One, that the park was going to be sold to an as-yet-unknown entity, and secondly, the reports from the USDA of the ill health that Toki was in. As word spread within the whale community that the Miami Seaquarium was going to be sold to the Dolphin Company, their corporate office is located in Cancun, Mexico, Vinick and others officially began to make concerted efforts to contact the new owner and the company's CEO, Eduardo Albor. Unlike previous efforts to communicate with former owners of the Miami Seaquarium, which were wholly unsuccessful, ignored, and stubbornly dismissed, the effort to reach out to the Dolphin Company was successful early on. A representative of the company responded to Vinick's and others' inquiries, agreeing to meet once the park was sold and they were the new owners. According to Vinick, they would be prepared to meet with us and visit with us about our interests, and our interests at that time were really about bringing independent veterinarians in to assess Toki's health, because of all we've heard, but had no real data about, and the public was still in the dark. Long story short, in March of 2022, the announcement came that the Dolphin Company had purchased Miami Seaquarium and that they were taking over. A number of us, including Raynell, Ellie, and myself, were in Florida at the time to be there. Enter another key player in the effort to help Scully Chuktanot, Pritam Singh, a wealthy South Florida benefactor who, according to Vinick, knew the executive producer of the film and had a strong interest in helping improve Scully Chuktanot's conditions at the park. Pritam reached out to Eduardo Albor again, says Vinick, asking if they could discuss the situation about Toki. Eduardo responded to him, and they agreed to meet. The meeting resulted in an agreement to allow an independent veterinarian to visit and assess Toki's health and welfare on a regular basis, which proceeded monthly thereafter. Further conversations following that initial collaboration were unique, says Vinick. The theme of collaboration is what I think is unique for those of us who are supporters of Toki in every way, working hand in hand with the owners of a marine park, in this case, of Miami Seaquarium, to work together towards the highest quality of life for her, and the objective of moving her back to the waters of the Salish Sea. This unique collaboration over the following year would lead to building further trust and respect between all involved. Historically cold relations of the past began to warm between the park's trainers and veterinarians and the independent veterinarians and trainers that began to enter the park to work with Scully Chuktanot. A subsequent $1 million donation by Pritam Singh would not only solidify that collaboration, but also lead to a number of important improvements in Scully Chuktanot's environment. When Pritam Singh personally put up $1 million to help rebuild the infrastructure in the park, says Vinick, we built new filters for her water filtration system and a new ozone system replacing the chlorine system. So her life support system, as we refer to it, and all her water systems for her environment would be as up-to-date as we could possibly make them. The new water systems allow the staff and veterinarians to control the temperature, adjust the pH, maintain salinity, and all of the features needed to operate a high-quality water system, adds Vinick, even though it's an old system. Another condition following the sale of the park was an agreement between the park and the government to no longer put Scully Chuktanot on public display. To acquire a license to operate the rest of the park, the license from the Department of Agriculture Animal Plant Health Inspection Services does not include the tank holding Scully Chuktanot and a Pacific white-sided dolphin companion held with her. Current restrictions are due to the conditions of the whale pool and especially the surrounding stadium superstructure, which has been deemed to not meet current code requirements for Miami-Dade County, who leases the land to the park. According to Vinick, due to these restrictions, there were limits on who can visit and how many people could be in the whale stadium at any one time. With significant progress having been made to improve Scully Chuktanot's health and life support systems, the task ahead was just beginning to shift and focus on Toki and her proposed move to the Salish Sea, when she suddenly passed away Friday. Following her death, Tokite's body was removed Friday evening from the pool by the very sling she was trained to use for her return to her home waters. According to reports, her body was loaded into an ice-packed semi-truck and taken to the University of Georgia, which has the necessary facilities to do a necropsy on the famous orca. At press time, the results of the necropsy had not been released, as it can take several days or more to determine a whale's cause of death. Currently, there are efforts underway by the Lummi Nation and others to bring Tokite's body back to the Pacific Northwest for either a proper burial or some other way to celebrate her life. Research aims to uncover causes of eelgrass decline. Eelgrass, a flowering plant that grows in shallow marine waters, supports marine food webs, including Dungeness crabs, spawning habitat for Pacific herring, and feeding and resting habitat for out-migrating juvenile salmon. Eelgrass also enhances water quality and helps protect shorelines from wave-driven erosion. Eelgrass is even good at storing carbon. Unfortunately, many eelgrass meadows in the San Juans are declining. This summer, Friends of the San Juans began a new multi-year research project examining the health of eelgrass across the county. New research includes detailed surveys of eelgrass depth and distribution at 20 sites, as well as mapping of the deep water edge of eelgrass beds across the entire county. Experts from the Washington Department of Natural Resources and Marine Resources Consultants are using underwater videography from the research vessel Brendan D-2 to map eelgrass across the county. You may see them moving methodically across the shallow water this month or next at a shoreline near you. Information from this project will help researchers answer a very important question. Why is eelgrass declining at so many sites in the San Juan Islands? Scientists at Cornell and Friday Harbor Labs have been studying eelgrass wasting disease as one part of this complex puzzle. In collaboration with eelgrass disease experts, Friends of the San Juan's staff and community science volunteers collected a small number of eelgrass plants through snorkel surveys. Plants from 10 sites on San Juan, Orcas, Lopez, Shaw, and Waldron Islands are being analyzed for disease as part of this countywide project. The project is a partnership between Friends of the San Juans, the Washington Department of Natural Resources, and researchers from Cornell University and Friday Harbor Marine Labs. Special thanks to project funders, the Washington State Salmon Recovery Funding Board, the SeaDoc Society, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Friends of the San Juans members. Our appreciation also goes to the landowners who provided shoreline access for the snorkel sample, and the volunteers who assisted with field surveys and lab processing. Eelgrass mapping results will be compared with 2003 mapping data, providing a valuable understanding of how eelgrass growth, depths, and distribution trends have changed in the San Juans over the past 20 years. Expanded eelgrass wasting disease data applied with the trend data can help us understand why eelgrass is declining, identify resilient eelgrass meadows, and inform future salmon recovery protection efforts. For more information, visit sanjuans.org or email friends@sanjuans.org. And now, choice excerpts from the San Juan County Sheriff's log. On August 9th, a deputy on Orcas struck a mailbox while backing up. Some owners of the mailbox were notified, and the deputy fixed the mailbox stand, which received minimal damage. On August 11th, an Orcas Island deputy stopped a vehicle on Orcas Road. The driver, a visitor to the island, was subsequently issued an infraction for speeding 68 miles per hour in a 40-mile-per-hour zone. Listen, if you're that late to the ferry, putting other people's lives at risk is not worth it. Just get the next one. A deputy was dispatched to a suspicious circumstance in the Friday Harbor area. The person reported that they located footprints on their deck when they woke up. A report was taken. On August 13th, an Orcas Island deputy responded to the substation for two garbage bags of wet clothing left on the front porch of the station. The clothing was unidentifiable and soaking wet. It was properly disposed of at the station. Perhaps someone thought they would turn themselves in for improper laundering. On August 15th, a deputy on Orcas Island responded to a report of a naked elderly man at a public beach. Several witnesses were contacted and questioned. The witnesses expressed concern over the subject's mental state. The subject was identified and contacted. Perhaps the subject was also informed that generally one's safer to do that on Lopez. And that concludes the August 23rd edition of the Island Digest. This edition is brought to you by Orcas Center. Orcas Center is your place for fun and intrigue this summer with live concerts, performances, art openings, and more. To check out upcoming events and purchase tickets, visit www.orcascenter.org. Thank you for listening to the Island Digest, a small sampling of what's in your local print newspapers this week. The Journal, Sounder, and Weekly rely upon advertising, subscriptions, and donations to support our mission of high-quality community journalism. To contribute, visit our websites or email publisher Colleen Smith Summers at csmith@soundpublishing.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and come back next week for more local news from San Juan County, Washington. I'm Caleb Summers.